A great pleasure to have Cecilia. She recently graduated from Yale University, and she just moved to Caltech last September. She, as you know, she has done pioneering work which sort of promotes quantum metrology to modern quantum information theory setting by using QEC. And I think she will tell us exactly about this error-corrected quantum metrology. So please.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for having me here. So today I'm going to talk about some of my work on the topic of error-corrected quantum metrology. So specifically, I'm going to talk about how noise affects the precision in quantum metrology and how you can use quantum error correction to reduce the effect of noise in the procedure. So, let's first ask what is quantum metrology and why do we care about it? So to summarize in one sentence, quantum metrology is basically the science of estimation in quantum systems. And it is important in many different physical scenarios. So for example, in optical interferometry, people need to estimate the phase difference between two optical passes. And then people can use that to, for example, detect gravitational wave. And people have also been thinking about how to use different type of quantum input state to sort of enhance the estimation precision in this type of experiment. So that's where quantum metrology plays an important role. And another setting would be in atomic clock, where people need to estimate the frequency of laser repeatedly in order to correct the fluctuation, so that we would have a clock. And people have also been researching using different type of input state, or basically employing the entanglements between these atoms in order to increase the precision in these clocks. And also, like people have also been considering using nitrogen vacancy centers in diamonds to detect magnetic field or electric field. And also, it's also important to find out different type of quantum controls in order to extend the coherence time of these electric spins in the diamonds. So basically, there are many different settings where quantum metrology plays an important role, and I'm not going to talk about them in detail here. Instead, my talk is going to focus on the theoretical aspect behind this experiment, and basically, what is the theoretical estimation limit in these settings. So basically, in all of these experiments, the underlying structure is basically the same. So we have this diagram, which is an abstraction of all these experiments. So we have some input quantum state, and we also have some quantum dynamic, where we have some unknown parameter we want to estimate. And we also have some quantum noise, whose effects we want to reduce. And we also can apply different types of quantum control on the system. And finally, we need a quantum measurement to extract all of the data from the system. So my talk is mostly going to focus on the situation where given a specific quantum dynamics, what would be the optimal way to choose the input state, the quantum control, and the measurement. And under the condition that they can be chosen arbitrarily. And then what would be the ultimate theoretical estimation limit behind this type of protocols. So this brings me to the outline of my talk. So I'm first going to review some basic concepts in quantum metrology. So I'm first going to talk about classical and quantum estimation theory. And then I'm going to give you some examples of quantum metrology with special emphasis on the effect of noise. And then I'm going to move on to talk about general quantum channel estimation, where quantum error correction plays an important role. And specifically, I'm going to focus on two aspects in quantum channel estimation. The first one is on the scaling of the estimation limit. Basically, we have two types of estimation limits, Heisenberg limit and standard quantum limit. And we will see a dichotomy between these two. And then I'm going to talk about how to find out the exact value of the estimation precision by optimizing different error correction strategies. So, so now let's talk about classical estimation theory. So in the setting of classical estimation theory, we usually have some unknown parameter omega. And we can estimate the value of omega by sampling from a random variable x. And the probability distribution of x is going to be a function of omega. So basically, we would have some estimate of omega hat, which is a function from the domain of x to the domain of omega. And we would usually assume that the estimator is unbiased, basically means that if we take the expectation value of the estimator, it's going to be give us its true value. And in that situation, we can define the figure of merit, which is the estimation precision, given by the standard deviation of this omega hat. And basically, the lower the estimation precision is, the better the estimator is. And we want to sort of minimize this function over all type of unbiased estimators. And actually, we have a very nice theoretical lower bound of this delta omega given by 1 over the square root of n times f. So this bound is called Cramer bound. And n here is basically the number of experiments or the number of samples of x we are getting here. And f is the so-called Fisher information. It is a function of p, the probability distribution. And we can sort of understand it as some kind of distance function between the probability at p omega and the probability at p omega plus d omega. And more importantly, this lower bound is actually saturable asymptotically. So one can prove that when the number of experiments is infinitely large, the maximum likelihood estimator is going to be unbiased and also asymptotically saturate this lower bound. So that's why Fisher information is an important concept in estimation theory. And now I'm going to give you an example of classical Fisher information. So this is the exact expression of the classical Fisher information. And we can take a look at a very simple example where we just have a Bernoulli distribution where the probability of getting zero is omega and the probability of getting one is one minus omega. So you can plug it into the definition of Fisher information and you can get one over omega times one minus omega. So basically it tells you that when omega is around the corner of zero or one, the Fisher information is going to be large. That means it is relatively easy to obtain the value of omega. But when omega is around one half, the Fisher information is the smallest. So that's the most difficult situation in this Bernoulli distribution setting. So usually in when we go from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics, we will need to generalize some real functions to an operator. And this is also true when we want to generalize the definition of classical Fisher information to quantum Fisher information. So so basically, classical Fisher information can be written as an expectation value of some function L square, where L is the derivative of the log P function. So the exact expression is not important, but basically, in order to generalize to quantum Fisher information, we just need to lift L from a function to a Hermitian operator. And we also need to lift P, which is the probability distribution, to a density matrix rho omega here, so that we can use them to define the quantum Fisher information, which is basically, again, the expectation value of this L square on the density matrix. So this gives us a quantum analog of the classical Fisher information. But then what would be the operational meaning of this quantum analog of classical fishing information? So that brings us to the setting in quantum estimation theory. So basically in quantum estimation theory, instead of having a probability distribution P, we would have a density matrix rho omega, where basically the density matrix is a function of omega. And we need to perform some quantum measurements on this density matrix to get a random variable x, and then we can use again the estimator to estimate the value of omega. So then one can prove that the definition of quantum fishing information is exactly given by the maximization of the classical fishing information over a possible POVM, which is the quantum measurement on the density matrix. So then it will be clear. We can also interpret this quantum fishing information as some kind of distance metric between rho omega and rho omega plus the omega. So it is a function that does not depend on the POVM. And using this definition, one can go from the classical Cramer bound to quantum Cramer bound, which basically states that the estimation precision is lower bounded by 1/√ of n times f. So again, n is the number of experiments, but f here is the quantum fishing information. And also it is immediately clear from this equation that the quantum Cramer bound is also searchable asymptotically using maximum likelihood estimator. So basically the quantum fishing information is going to be the main focus of my talk. That's why I'm going to give you some examples of it. So the first example is going to be pure state. So by pure state, I mean I have some pure state which is governed by some Hamiltonian evolution, where the Hamiltonian is omega times h. So omega is basically the strength of the Hamiltonian. And in that case, the quantum fishing information would be 4 times t squared times the variance of h on the initial state. So one thing I'm going to emphasize here is that the fishing information is proportional to t squared. So that is important because for most noisy states, we don't have this type of scaling. And to give you a more specific example, we could consider a single qubit state where the Hamiltonian is a Pauli Z matrix over 2. So then we can see from this plot of Bloch sphere that we need to choose an initial state on the equator of this Bloch sphere in order to maximize this variance of H. So for example, we could choose it to be plus state, which is a equal superposition between 0 and 1 with the same amplitude. And so this is the example in the situation where we don't have any noise. What happens if we have noise? So now I'm going to consider only defacing noise. So again, we have some Hamiltonian, which is Pauli Z matrix over 2. And I'm going to consider the defacing noise with some noise rate gamma. So we already know that in the situation where gamma is 0, the fishing information is going to be proportional to t squared. And in the noisy case, one can show that the fishing information is going to have this exponentially decaying term with a rate proportional to gamma. So we can sort of visualize this distinction on this plot. So we are plotting the overlap between initial state and the final state. So in the noiseless case, we have a oscillation with frequency proportional to omega. But in the noisy case, instead of having only the oscillation, we also have some exponentially decaying term. So that explains why when t goes to infinity, basically we would have no coherency on this qubit, and the fishing information would also go to 0. So we cannot detect anything useful from that. So then we have to measure and renew the qubit every constant time instead of going to infinity. So in that case, we can get only the quantum fishing emission proportional to t. So that shows a distinction in the noiseless case and noisy case. And we could also consider the dependence of fission information with respect to the number of qubits. So that's why we're going to consider a n-qubit defacing channel where we have a single qubit defacing channel on each of the qubits. So if the input state is GHZ state, in a noiseless case, one can compute that the fission information is going to be proportional to n squared. And the reason is that the phase is going to accumulate n times faster than before. So that's why we have this type of scaling here. But in the noisy case, we would have also a exponentially decaying term. And moreover, the decaying constant is going to be n times larger than the previous case. So basically now we can see that on this plot, the oscillation is going to be much faster than previously, but the decaying is also much faster. So in that case, one can try to compute the average QFI over time, which is the maximization of this F over T. So one can show that in that case, it is only going to be proportional to N, instead of proportion to n squared. And more importantly, this function is going to be exactly the same as in the situation where we have a input state, which is a product state of the plus state. So basically it is saying that the effect of having a larger signal is canceled out by the effect of having a larger noise rate. So basically in the long run, there's no advantage of using GHZ state instead of just product state if we have like an infinitely long sensing time. So to summarize, in quantum metrology, the resource we care about is the number of channels we use or the probing time. So, and there are two types of estimation precision limits. The first one is called the Heisenberg limit, where the QFI is either proportional to n squared or t squared. And it is actually the ultimate estimation precision limit allowed by quantum mechanics. So another limit, which is called the standard quantum limit, is describes the situation where QFI is proportional to n or proportional to t. And it is a somehow classical limit because it is actually achievable using a classical strategy because we can just use product state and or we can just renew the qubit every constant time. So now the question is in general, how to determine whether or not we can achieve the Heisenberg limit or standard quantum limit. So is noise always detrimental? And also how to find the best strategy to optimize the fission information. So so this brings me to the second part of my talk, which is describes general quantum channel estimation. And I'm going to especially talk about the distinction between Heisenberg limit and standard quantum limit for arbitrary quantum channel. And I'm also going to talk about how to optimize the fission information using quantum error correction strategies. So first, what is quantum channel estimation? So by quantum channel estimation, I'm considering the following situation. We have some quantum channel, which is a function of omega. And instead of considering the Fisher information of a fixed quantum state, I'm going to consider the Fisher information of a quantum channel where the input and input state could be chosen arbitrarily. So basically, that is going to be the setting we're going to consider. And a simple example would be we have a unitary channel. In that case, the quantum channel is just going to be governed by this Hamiltonian evolution with omega times h. And then as we already seen on the previous slide, the optimal input state would just be the state which maximizes the variance of H. But we can also consider the situation where we have noise in this quantum channel. So for example, if we have first the unitary evolution and then we have some kind of noisy channel after the unitary evolution. And most general, I'm going to consider like arbitrary situation where the Hamiltonian, where the cross operator of this quantum channel is basically a function of omega. But of course, we need some regularity condition on these cross operators. So I'm going to actually consider the scaling of the quantum fishing information of a quantum channel with respect to the number of quantum channels we use. So in that case, for example, we have n copies of quantum channels, then I'm going to consider two types of strategy to estimate the value of omega. So the first strategy is called a parallel strategy. So that describes the situation where we could have an input state, which have n probes, and it could also be an entangled state, which a bunch of unbounded ancillas, and we could also have arbitrary measurement in the end. So I'm going to consider the fishing information of the output state with respect to the number of channels we use. And another strategy, which is more general than the parallel strategy, is called sequential strategy. So in the setting of sequential strategy, we actually, instead of allowing arbitrary input and measurement, we can also have arbitrary quantum controls acting after the application of each quantum channel. So I'm going to consider the scaling of fishing information in these two settings. And we can also consider the scaling of fishing information with respect to time by basically consider the evolution of master equation. So in this setting, we are going to take the limit of very small time step. In that case, we can only need to consider the first order approximation of these quantum channels, which is described by the master equation. So so we can see that it is actually a very special case of the sequential strategy. So that's why I'm not going to talk about this in detail. But basically, we can sort of have this Hamiltonian again, which is omega times h. And we could also have some kind of noise operators described by this L operators. Okay, so now I'm going to state the two important questions that I care about. The first one is Heisenberg limit vs standard quantum limit. So to be specific, I'm going to ask, given an arbitrary quantum channel, is it possible to achieve the Heisenberg limit using parallel or sequential strategies? So basically, as we will see below, if we cannot achieve the Heisenberg limit, we can only achieve the standard quantum limit. So these are the only two types of scaling allowed in the setting I mentioned before. And then more importantly, more carefully, we do need to care about the exact value of the QFI, because we are not going to only care about the scaling. We also need to care about the exact value of the QFI. So we are going to ask what would be the optimal QFI coefficient in both of these settings. For example, if we have a Heisenberg limit, then what would be the coefficient of this quadratic term? And if we have only standard quantum limit, then what would be the optimal coefficient for this linear term? So to answer these two questions, we will need to handle this question from two directions. The first one is going to be the upper bound of fishing information, and the second one would be the lower bound of the fishing information. So basically, if the upper bound matches the lower bound, that would give us a definitive answer on whether or not we can achieve the Heisenberg limit. So actually, we need to solve these two problems using different techniques. So the first one, in order to derive the upper bound of fishing information, we have to use channel extension method. So it's not clear why it's called this name at this stage, but I'm going to talk about this later. And the lower bound is basically quantum error correction. So we are going to first have some upper bound of phishing information, and then we are going to show that by using optimization of quantum error correction protocols, we can actually achieve this upper bound given by channel estimation, channel extension method, and therefore would give us some definitive answer of these three questions. So now I'm going to first briefly talk about what is channel extension method, and then I'm going to move on to talk about quantum error correction after I talk about this upper bound. So in order to understand what would be the scaling of phishing information with respect to the number of channels we use, we actually first need to understand what would happen if we only have one single quantum channel. So that is also not explained before. So if we have just a single quantum channel, we can define a function which is called a channel QFI. So it's going to be a function of the channel only after we minimize over all possible input states with the assistance of ancillas. And one can actually get a very simple, okay, it's not very simple, but it's efficiently computable function, which is the value of the channel QFI. So it's actually, so the exact expression is not important, but basically, we only need to know that it is a function of cross operator and the derivative of cross operator. So alpha here is some Hermitian operator, and this is, norm is here is the operator norm. And we are going to minimize the norm of alpha, where alpha is some Hermitian operator. And this would give us the value of the channel QFI. And actually, this whole thing is efficiently computable using semi-definite program. So in order to go from a single quantum channel to n copies of quantum channel, we could just plug in the expression for the expression for the cross operator here in the setting of single quantum channel. And then if we put some restriction on the small h, we could get some useful upper bound on this channel QFI. So again, in these two settings, the parallel strategy and sequential strategy, we would have different type of upper bound on the phishing information. In the first case, the phishing information upper bound is going to have two terms, a linear term and a quadratic term. And also the situation is the same in the sequential strategy, but the coefficient of the quadratic term is going to be different from the one in the parallel strategy. But the linear term is actually the same. So, but we can see that if there exists some small h such that beta is zero, then the second term is going to vanish. And that means we do not have a quadratic scaling anymore. So basically, we can see that the Heisenberg limit is not achievable if there exists a small h such that beta is zero. And this is actually described the situation for many typical quantum noise. So for example, consider a single qubit. If we have depolarizing noise, then we can show that beta is zero for some h. And also, if we have only dephasing noise, but Pauli signal, which is parallel to the dephasing noise. In that case, we can also find some h such that beta is zero. So basically in both of these two examples, we can always find some h such that beta is zero. And in that case, we can never achieve the Heisenberg limits with arbitrary, basically even with the optimal strategy, we cannot achieve the Heisenberg limit in these two settings. So that answers the question of upper bounds on quantum phishing information. And now I'm going to talk about lower bound.
I think there is a question.
Yeah.
So, hello, Gamal Aflam speaking. In you mentioned for the depolarizing channel and for the usual decoherence, what about what is called T1 or thermal relaxation? Can you find a beta equal to zero in that case?
Yeah, I think so. So, I'm not confident what exactly is thermal relaxation cross operators, but if we have, for example, like amplitude damping channel, then also we can show that basically there's always an edge such that beta is zero. So basically if the noise operator is the span of the entire Hermitian operator space, then basically no matter what is the Hamiltonian, it is going to be there's a way to make beta equal to zero. Yeah.
And my second question is, where does this H come from?
Okay, sorry, I didn't specify this clearly. So basically, if we have a quantum channel, then there's multiple different ways to write it in the cross operator representation. So we can choose different type of cross operator to represent a same quantum channel. And basically this H is the degree of freedom in choosing different cross operators.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for asking the question. Yeah. So
I also have a question. So actually, how did you arrive at this upper bound? How do you derive these upper bound?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. Oh. So basically, if we have this Fisher information for a single quantum channel, we can go to the multiple copies if we just write down a cross operator of multiple quantum channels, and then we can sort of assume H is like block diagonal on each subsystem. So in that case, one can write down this upper bound. So basically, the exact value if we have n copies would be minimized over all possible H. But if we assume H is block diagonal for each subsystem, then we can get this upper bound. Yeah.
I see. Thanks. Okay.
So So basically this summarizes the upper bound of quantum fish information. And now I'm going to talk about basically how to achieve this upper bound using quantum error correction. So basically I'm going to show that the condition that there exists on H such that beta is zero is actually a necessary and sufficient condition. If beta is not zero, it's a necessary and sufficient condition to achieve the Heisenberg limit. So now I'm just going to state formally what I just said. Basically, one can translate the condition that beta is not zero to this so-called Hamiltonian nodding crossband condition. So basically, what I'm going to show is that the Heisenberg limit is achievable using Hell layout strategy or sequential strategy, if and only if this condition holds. And this is the so the condition is called Hamiltonian nodding crossband is because we can define an operator which is the Hamiltonian of a quantum channel and an operator which is the crossband of a quantum channel. An operator subspace which is the crossband of a quantum channel. So we first write down the cross operator of the quantum channel, then we can calculate this function, which we will call the Hamiltonian of this channel. And we can also write down the span of Ki dagger Kj terms for arbitrary I and j. And here this, I'm only considering the set of Hermitian matrix for this crossband. So if Hamiltonian is inside this span of cross operators, then we cannot achieve the Heisenberg limit. But if the Hamiltonian is not in the crossband, we can always find some error correction strategy to achieve the Heisenberg limit. And I'm also going to explain why we call this operator the Hamiltonian. The reason is very clear. So if we have a unitary channel, then we can write down it as the exponential of omega times h. And then we can directly plug it in here. We can find out that the Hamiltonian of this channel is exactly equal to the natural definition of the Hamiltonian. So that, and we can generalize this whole thing to like arbitrary quantum channel. So so this is the theorem I'm trying to show. I'm already show one direction, which is the fishing information upper bound, and now I'm going to show you how to use quantum error correction to basically achieve the Heisenberg limit when this condition is satisfied. So before I talk about the error correction strategy, I'm just going to talk about a simple example where it's clear like how to achieve the Heisenberg limit. So the simple example would be the situation where we have a Pauli Z signal with bit flip noise. So so now we are going to consider a unitary revolution with Pauli Z signal. And after that, we would have some bit flip noise on this quantum channel. So in that case, we can directly see that the HNKS condition is satisfied because the Hamiltonian is Pauli Z and the noise span is Pauli X and identity. So then one can actually use a code which is just repetition code. So we have some noiseless ancilla and we and S is the physical system. So in that case, after an error happens on the system, basically we would have basically the whole quantum state would be mapped to another subspace with a different parity between these two register. And then it became clear that we can recover, perform the recovery channel by mapping the charity between these two. And then what's important is that this whole process is actually commute with the Hamiltonian evolution. So it does not affect the signal Hamiltonian evolution here. So that's why just by using this repetition code, we can correct all type of bit flip noise, but we can also have the original Hamiltonian evolution. So that's why we can get a unitary evolution in the logical space. And as we've seen on the previous slide, if we have a unitary evolution, we have the Heisenberg limit. So that's a simple example how error correction would work. And okay, so in general, what is quantum error correction? So quantum error correction describes—
Can I ask one more question on the— okay. Do you assume the ancilla are noiseless in here?
Yeah, exactly. So so we assume that the ancilla is noiseless here. And that is in principle possible because we can have a bunch of qubit here and we can do a first layer like error correction on the ancilla, and then we do the second layer on this whole system. So that's one possible way to explain why we might have noiseless ancilla in real life. Yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Thank you. So I see there's another question.
I have another question. Hi, Cici. Could we go back to two slides before where you were giving the Hamiltonian not in Krauss span condition?
Yeah.
And you define the Hamiltonian here. So this is the signal Hamiltonian, right? Or is this the noise Hamiltonian? Okay.
Yeah, the signal Hamiltonian, yeah.
Okay, but we're expressing it in terms of a different set of Krauss operators and the noise operators. Are the K the noise operators here, or are they just a different?
Oh, so basically K is the Krauss operator of the entire channel. So okay. It will also contain both signal and noise. Yeah.
Thanks, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So okay, so in the general setting of quantum error correction, we will have some subspace of the entire Hilbert state, which we call P. And error correction is possible as long as the cross operator map the logical space to different orthogonal subspace. And the subspace does not deform. So if these two conditions are satisfied, we can find some recovery channel such that quantum error correction is possible. So actually these two conditions I just mentioned can be summarized by this, this property here. So P is the projection onto the logical subspace, and K is the cross operator for the noise. And then the error correction is possible as long as this KJ dagger KK terms in the subset of logical subspace is proportional to the identity in the logical subspace. So this is called the Kniel-Laflamme condition. And so this is just describe the situation without sensing. So if we just have some noise, what would be possible just to get a identity channel after we apply a recovery channel. And in the setting of quantum sensing, we would actually have an additional condition instead of this one. So again, to correct noise, we would also need the Kniel-Laflamme condition to be satisfied, which is basically the one I'm showing on the previous slides. But since we have an additional ancilla, which is noiseless, so we also have this tensor product with identity operator on the ancilla. And instead of having only this condition, we also need an additional condition in order to detect non-trivial signal in the logical subspace. And that is going to be this one. So basically the Hamiltonian projected onto the logical subspace has to be non-trivial. So it has to be not proportional to the projector onto the code space. So we can directly see that in order to satisfy these two conditions, we must have a Hamiltonian not in the crossband. So, but how do we justify these two conditions? So why is it possible to achieve the Heisenberg limit as long as these two conditions are satisfied? So I'm not to explain in detail, but I'm just going to give you an intuitive setting. So if we have a Hamiltonian evolution look like this and some noise operator looks like this, then if we can find some recovery channel such that we can have a identity operator on the code subspace, then we can just okay, we also assume in this setting that omega is approximately zero. So we can do the Taylor expansion and we can see that the logical Hamiltonian in the code subspace is actually this H effective, which is given by P times H times P. So basically the logical Hamiltonian is going to be given by this one. And if we have a logical Hamiltonian, which is not trivial, then basically we can have a unitary quantum channel evolution and we can use that unitary logical subspace to do the sensing, which would give us the Heisenberg limit. And so now the question is how to construct a code that satisfies these two conditions if the HNKS condition is satisfied. So this is just a diagram showing like how HNKS condition works. So we must have some Hamiltonian which is not inside the crossband, and that means we have some H perpendicular, which is the orthogonal projection of H onto the orthogonal space perpendicular to S. So H perpendicular has to be non-zero, and that's the condition. That's the condition H and KS condition. So in that situation, we can write down H perpendicular as some difference between two density matrix proportional to the distance between two density matrix, sigma zero and sigma one. So I'm going to, because H perpendicular is traceless because it is proportional to the crossband, it can always be written as written down as some difference between two positive matrix, and after the rescaling, we would have two density matrix. So after we have this density matrix, we can just define the code space to be the purification of these two density matrix on the noiseless ancilla. So sigma zero and sigma one is the density matrix, and then we have the code space, which is two dimensional, and it is defined to be the purification of sigma zero and sigma one. And one can directly verify that these two conditions is actually satisfied using this simple definition of quantum code. And then we already know that we can recover a unitary dynamic on the logical subspace. So that's why we can just recover the Heisenberg limit using the logical GHD state. So that is a code construction which helps us understand that why when the HNKS condition is satisfied, we can achieve the Heisenberg limit, and basically proves that condition is necessary and sufficient. So we can use this the same strategy by optimizing this sigma zero and sigma one in order to achieve the optimal Heisenberg limit coefficient. So basically here we see that, again, we are showing the upper bound of the Fish information. And we have this quadratic term, which is equal to 4 times norm of beta square. And we are actually going to show this coefficient is optimal. So and I'm going to sort of help you understand what is this function here. So actually beta can be viewed as the distance between H and arbitrary, basically the distance between H and the crossband. So here K dagger HK is an arbitrary operator in the crossband. And by minimizing the norm of beta over all possible H is basically finding the distance between H and the crossband. So that is intuitive, and we can attain this upper bound using QEC protocol. So I'm not going to talk about this in detail here, but basically we can, instead of choosing sigma zero and sigma one to be the positive and negative part of H perpendicular, we are going to assume it is an arbitrary function. And then we are going to maximize the fishing information under the condition that the error correction is possible. So then after the optimization, we find out that the exact expression of vision information is going to be equal to this upper bound. So that basically shows that error correction strategy is not only possible to achieve the upper bound, but also possible to achieve the optimal coefficient. And also in the case of standard quantum limit, the situation is actually going to be a bit more complicated because we can no longer use the Kniella-Lamb condition, because in that case, both the Hamiltonian and the crossband would be identity operators in the code subspace. And that is not good because that does not help us detect any useful signal. So in that case, we need to use approximate quantum error correction protocol. So that means we would need a quantum error correction such that the noise is not completely eliminated in the logical space. And also we would have a non-zero signal in the logical subspace. So because, as I said previously, the upper bound of both the parallel and sequential strategy is the same. So it is basically 4 times the norm of alpha. And it basically shows that we can achieve this upper bound using approximate QEC protocol. And it is also a sign that parallel strategy and sequential strategy is equally powerful in terms of this SQL coefficient. So what would be the approximate QEC protocol? So this is just two simple steps, decomposition of the approximate QEC protocol. So the first step would be to use approximate QEC for defacing channel. So actually we do not need use any QEC for defacing channel. We just need to prove that this upper bound is actually saturable by some quantum state using under the setting of defacing channel. So this is our definition of defacing channel. It is slightly different from the traditional definition. So by defacing channel, I'm actually mean a quantum channel which does not affect the diagonal element of a density matrix, but the off-diagonal part is going to be multiplied by some complex number, Kasi. And in that case, if the absolute value of Kasi is equal to one, we would just have a Pauli Z rotation on this defacing channel. So in that case, we already know that we can achieve the Heisenberg limit using the logical GHZ state. But actually, in the situation where the absolute value of Kasi is smaller than one, we can actually also prove that there exists some logical spin squeeze state to achieve the optimal SQL coefficient. So basically, it shows that we can achieve the upper bound in terms of defacing channel. And then step two would just be to reduce arbitrary quantum channel to defacing channel using some special encoding strategy. And I'm not going to talk about it involves just an additional ancilla, which indicates zero logical state or one logical state. And then it basically can be used to correct all type of bit flip noise, which give us only defacing noise in the end. So, and then the step three would be to optimize the fission information of this defacing channel over all possible encoding. And then it would give us the SQL, optimal SQL coefficient. So basically this shows that by using approximate quantum error correction, it is possible to achieve the optimal SQL coefficient. And I'm just going to talk about this last example, which is Pauli Z signal with amplitude damping noise. So basically, amplitude damping noise describes the situation where it is possible to decay from one to zero with some noise probability P. And we also have some Pauli Z rotation as the signal. So in that case, one can verify that the crossband is actually the entire Hermitian operator subspace. So the Hamiltonian is inside the crossband. So in that case, we cannot achieve the Heisenberg limit, but we can calculate the optimal QL. FQL coefficient, which is given by this one. So we can see that this whole thing is proportional to 1 over p. So basically, when p goes to 0, the coefficient actually goes to infinity. So that matches our intuition, because when p is 0, we can actually achieve the Heisenberg. So there is definitely have to be some like smooth transition here. So it also shows that quantum error correction is useful, because if we just have a product state, then the SQL is just going to be a constant, not going to be proportional to 1 over p. And actually, one can solve the previous protocol and have this new optimal code, which looks like this. So we have some very small parameter delta and epsilon. So as long as delta and epsilon are both very small, we can achieve the optimal SQL coefficient. So basically, we can see the ratio between the logical defacing channel, which is the fission information we can get, and the optimal coefficient, which is the upper bound. And we can see that the ratio between the quantum fission information we can get and the upper bound is approach one when delta is very small, and also when epsilon is small. So so this is our last example. So to summarize, in the situation where Hamiltonian is not inside the crossband, we can actually use a logical GHZ state to recover the Heisenberg limit. And in the situation where the Hamiltonian is not in the when the Hamiltonian is actually inside the crossband, we can use a logical spin squeezed state. And the distinction between these two situations is that in the first case, the logical qubit is noiseless, but in the second case, the logical qubit is noisy. So let's summarize here. So basically, I've shown that the structure of the noise and the Hamiltonian determines the estimation precision limit in quantum metrology. And more importantly, quantum error correction is powerful. It can help us recover the Heisenberg limit and also achieve the optimal HL and SQL coefficient. So there are some other works that I didn't have the chance to mention here. For example, we consider a situation where we don't have noiseless ancilla. So basically, we only have the qubit and no ancilla. And we find some sufficient condition to achieve the optimal quantum fission information in the ancilla-free case. And we also discuss the situation of multiple parameter estimation. So in this paper, we discuss basically two types of quantum error correction protocol. The first protocol is to project everything into a single logical space where we both have the noise and the signal. And we also consider a different situation where we just project the system into different logical subspace, and each subspace is used to sense different type of signal. And we also compare the scaling of official information with respect to the number of parameters in these two settings and find out they are different. So, and we can also use this concept of channel quantum information to find some lower bound or limits in different quantum information tasks. For example, we could consider the setting of covariant quantum error correction, where basically describe the situation where the quantum code is covariant with respect to some U1 evolution given by the logical Hamiltonian and the system Hamiltonian. And we do find some useful lower bound, actually, some very efficient one using the definition of channel quantum error correction. So there are also some future direction or an unanswered question. Basically, is there any distinction between parallel strategy and sequential strategy when the Heisenberg limit is achievable? And also, basically, what would be the multi-parameter estimation limit for general quantum channel estimation? And also, what happens if there's noise in the quantum error correction step? So is error correction still useful if we have noise in the quantum error correction? So okay, so finally, I need to thank all of my co-authors and the funding agencies and my PhD schools. Yeah, okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for the great talk. So yeah, we have it's time for questions. So, Tim.
Hi, thanks for the great talk. I was just wondering if you could clarify this multi-parameter Hamiltonian. Like, do you mean you have like a Hamiltonian that's like a sum of operators and you're estimating like the coefficients of those operators, or?
Yeah, exactly. So in this setting, we are considering a Hamiltonian, which we have different generators of the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian is basically a linear combination of different terms with different parameters we want to estimate.
And what's the generalization of the bounds to that case?
Yeah, so actually in this case, we only consider the situation where the Heisenberg limit is achievable. So basically the generalization is basically that if all of these generators is not inside the crossband, then we can achieve the Heisenberg limit. And otherwise, we can never achieve the Heisenberg limit as long as like one of the generators is in the crossband. So that's... Mm. So that's the condition, and basically, we also focus on how to like optimize the quantum code in that setting, yeah, using like semi-definite program, and so on, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
with the next question, I think, Isha?
Yeah, I had a question. I had a couple of questions, but I can ask the second one after Kareem. So one question was about the Hamiltonian knot and crossband condition. So when I was reading one of the earlier papers by a group, I think the condition was phrased differently. It was Hamiltonian knot in Lindblad span. We were just looking at the cross operators modeling the noise channel. So I'm wondering, I mean, I looked at that and I'm wondering if it's like a trivial like step from that to this formulation, or is this condition different?
So actually, the Hamiltonian knot in the Lindblad span is actually a special case of this Hamiltonian knot in crossband. So that they are actually the same in the situation of, yeah. So they are actually the same in this situation, but actually in this situation, we only consider the parameter in the Hamiltonian, and in the general situation where we just have some cross operator, which is a function of omega, we can also generalize the definition of Hamiltonian in this setting to like the one on my later slides. So yeah, so basically using this, you can derive the Hamiltonian knot in Lindblad span, but not vice versa. So yeah.
Thanks, yeah.
Next question, Kareem.
I want to tell, I have a question about, could you recommend to me a title of paper or textbook about this topic, quantum error correction metrology?
Sorry, can you repeat the question again? I don't think I fully understood your question. Can you repeat it?
Okay. I said. Could you recommend to me a title of a textbook or paper about this topic, quantum error correction metrology?
Yeah. So so I don't think there's a book on this topic, but I think there are some useful reference that I may be able to recommend. I can maybe send you a link later.
Could you send its name in chat?
Oh yeah, I can send you the name in chat. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I think Ray.
On slide 14, you introduced the cross operator, and you made a comment that there were conditions on the cross operator. Were the conditions that they are in the span or not of the Hamiltonian that you want to observe, or there was the other condition that I don't know about? You made that comment that I didn't know.
Sorry. Can you like repeat your question again?
When you introduce a cross operator here, you said that there were conditions that the cross operators had to obey.
Yeah, so basically the condition is like if they are like second order differentiable with respect to omega, something like that.
Okay, so next let's take a question from Robert.
Thanks, Penny. And thanks for a nice talk. At the very end, you mentioned that one of the other topics you worked on is comparing parallel and sequential strategies when the Heisenberg limit is achievable. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't clear on what sorts of comparison you're making. Like what are you trying to decide there?
Yeah, so I think I didn't, I wasn't being very clear here because I was short on time. So basically, if we just take a look at this upper bound, we can see that the linear part is actually the same, but the quadratic part is different. So and using quantum error correction, we can achieve this upper bound for parallel strategy, but not this upper bound for sequential strategy. So it is still an open question. What would be the optimal quadratic coefficient in sequential strategy if we have arbitrary quantum controls here? So basically, quantum error correction can achieve both of this coefficient in the parallel setting, but for the sequential setting, the quadratic term is actually different. So basically that's an open question. Yeah, that's what I meant on the last slide.
I see. But if I understood you, the question is just whether the sequential strategy is as good as parallel or strictly worse, because it seems to me if you could saturate this upper bound, then it would be have the same scaling in beta.
Yeah, exactly. And actually there are already some evidence that basically sequential strategy is actually the same, because actually this upper bound might be tightened, but it's only in some specific case and we don't have a general answer right now. Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much.
Another question is Aisha again?
Yeah, I also just wanted to ask what your thoughts are on having like hybrid strategies, because here we have either a parallel strategy with n probes or one probe like n times, but let's say there's like a product where we have like p probes and m steps, so that would be like m times p is n, and maybe that could do even better than these two. So do you think there's a chance of combining parallel and sequential? And the reason why I'm wondering about this is because I think in an experimental setup, a sequential strategy is more easy. You can add a probe, you can add a time step, but it's harder to entangle a probe into your system. So I'm just wondering whether what your thoughts are on this.
So actually, that's a very good point. So I think it's definitely important to distinguish between parallel and sequential in experiments. And but like in the theoretical setting, I think because actually people have been conjectured that sequential strategy is actually the same as parallel strategy. So if we just do the hybrid, it wouldn't change the fission information much, because basically if we do the hybrid, the fission information is just going to be between the sequential and the parallel, and because parallel is actually equal to sequential, so we won't be able to have anything useful like using hybrid. But actually in experiments, actually you are right, because the resource we need in doing parallel is actually different from the resource we need in sequential, and that would be a different topic, because we would need to have a better figure of merit than just this vision information here. So that part I'm not sure. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so I think we had lots of questions. So I think it's time to finish the seminar. Thank you very much for the great talk. Let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you very much. That was very nice.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.